Elon Bay Brad, for those of you who came in late, that was Kyle Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party. My name is Samori Matsuman. If you don't have a program, well, you have it rough. The next speaker is Elon Bay Brad of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition.
Thank you very much, Brother Samori. This particular workshop, Resisting the U.S. Racist War Machine, is something that is very, very timely. Two Saturdays ago, on October the 20th, in New York City alone, over 20,000 people hit the streets to try to protest or initiate a protest against going into the Gulf region. At the same time, all over this country, in many cities, there were also similar outpourings. We saw it all over the world. And for the first time, Bush initiated this whole drive toward war, we started to see people put up a resistance. In Harlem, the members of the African and Latino community marched from 125th Street and Africa Square down first to Columbus Circle, where we pointed out that the refurbishing of a statue that showed the original invasion and rip off of this country that was trying to get ready for Columbus, polishing up the statue for the 1992 celebration of the quincentenary, that is the so-called 500th anniversary of the discovery of America. We related that to what the United States was doing in the Gulf region, and from there we participated in marching further to Herald Square, which is 34th Street, back at the Times Square, where this particular meeting developed. Now, I approached this thing somewhat like Carl from a personal experience. I was drafted in 1960, and I went to the draft board and told them I refused to kill any black, brown, red, or yellow people on the orders of any white man to fight a racist war. That time the United States was not even in Vietnam. They were in Laos, and they hadn't made their move yet. And of course, they gave me a questionnaire to fill out to say, well, if you say this, we want you to just document it. So I started to write out the thing, and it was so long that they told me just to sign it and give it over. But they couldn't do anything. Nobody at that time had made a move. There was no kind of rush to try to stop getting involved into Southeast Asia. About a year later, after the killing of Lumumba, they called me down again. I went before the, not so much the board, but even to deal with the military intelligence, where I dealt with at least four of them. And I told them I was even more vehemently against the war effort then, because since that time they had killed Lumumba. They gave me a quiz asking all kind of questions about my political beliefs and everything. It was 484 questions. The transcript was 82 pages, single space typing. And when they finished with it, there were black intelligence officers that actually dealt with this. At one point I told them, you know, that I was tired of the way they were being used as tools. They said, why are you saying that? For all you know, we could be on the same side. Well, I said, if we're on the same side, why am I on one side of the table answering questions? If you're on the other side answering questions, you know, there's no use for you to be doing that. If we're on the same side, I'm not going to participate in any war. But if you do force me to go in, anything I use within learning the military, I will use for the liberation of African people. That was the end of the discussion. It never bothered me again. As a matter of fact, several others went down there and repeated this, and that was before anyone started to really popularize the thing. Now, that came on more than just what Malcolm X was saying. Malcolm, because I told him at the time, too, that yes, I know Malcolm X. I mean, I've met him, you know. I have discussed things with him. But of course, I was more coming from the view of some of the Garveyite African nationalists, particularly like Carlos Cooks, who fought in the Second World War. The Second World War, when this question was posed before people like Elijah Muhammad, who did time for not going in the Second World War, but not go to fight their war. People like Carlos Cooks, being that he was a Dominican national and also feared that he could be deported from the country before he get a chance to complete his work, he went to the war. But the nationalists, the African nationalists, made a position that they would only fight in the Pacific theater, in the European theater. They would not fight in the Pacific theater. The reason is that although both of the forces of reaction and fascism were imperialists, the Japanese plan of what they were doing as far as imperialism in the Pacific theater was based on Colonel Tanaka's Hoysei economic sphere of influence. In other words, the Japanese believed that the Asians should be able to control all of the Asian territory. And that was something that we felt we shouldn't intervene with. But on the other hand, the Nazis and the fascists had a different idea. In Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler was putting forth that if he comes to power, he would reinstate Germany in the colonial territories of like Namibia and Togo and Cameroon. In the Italian fascists were talking about trying to reinstate themselves in Somalia, into Ethiopia and the northern, even the northern province of Eritrea. So therefore, in the European theater, those imperialist powers were definitely going to attack Africa. So many soldiers went to the European theater to fight against Nazism, to fight against fascism, because they really wanted to stop the Nazis returning to Africa and the fascists returning to also to Africa. So we saw that there was a reason that people put into their committing themselves to fight, that they had to have their own reasons. As a matter of fact, many of the nationalists tried to talk to the other leaders, including Ralph Bunche, to say, look, everybody was put into the Second World War. Everybody who was asked to produce soldiers were asking also for demands. For instance, that countries wanted that if the war was won, that they then would have their territories free. There was a big move to try to not just see the war fought for make Europe safe for democracy, but to make sure that people who were conscripted from the territories who had to go out and fight, that when they came back to their respective countries, they were not asked to be second-class citizens or to be dependents. And so we saw that after the Second World War, that people started to come back with that demand. In Manchester in 1945, we saw the Pan-African Congress come about, where people went back deliberately to either Ghana, Kenya, or what have you, and started to fight. We saw this in the case of the Kenya Land of Peace Freedom Army, so-called Mau Mau, when people like General China and Dedan Kamathi, people who had actually serviced the British in the fight to make Europe safe for democracy, then came back to try to make Africa also safe for democracy by getting rid of colonialism. So it was very, very important that the Second World War effort showed black people what they had to do. In the same token, black people in the United States who also went to the Second World War came out to make certain demands that they found resisted by the same people that sent them to war. For instance, there were black soldiers who were even watching and guarding German prisoners of war. And German prisoners of war, in at least several occasions, told these black soldiers, look, before this is over, we'll be in the United States and we will be full citizens, and you will still be the people who are second class citizens. And the black soldiers happened to see that. So he became very concerned that they didn't make any effort to go out to fight these wars because you're not getting the benefit of, you know, the so-called democratic tradition. So we started to see an interesting thing develop. We saw the Bangdong Conference in 1955, when Africans and Asians started to come together demand that their territories be let free from colonialism. We also started to see that the United States build up this whole idea of moving against the Soviet Union. The containment of communism became the major thing, the major thesis. And what happened after that was that every war was pictured in the position of how you fight, or any war effort was how you're going to fight the Soviet Union and its allies. At the same time, many people in the African national community said that we felt that Europe had learned that one of the things that they understood, that based on the idea that the Soviet Union and its allies and the United States and its allies were, as they said, guaranteed a mutually assured destruction, the so-called MAD theory, that because they were equally balanced because of having atomic power, that the Europeans would never fight against each other again, because therefore, the countries that had become decolonized and were only in a neo-colonial state now would finally get their freedom. So there was a kind of underlying understanding among the African nationalists that the Europeans would not fight each other. But at the same time, there was a basis for having the Europeans who were in the Eastern Bloc strong and determined, as long as they were going to back up the demands that the proletariat internationalists would call for, is that the colonies should be freed. And therefore, many people started to become very conscious that the ideological struggle had a very important part to play in the whole worldview that we needed to develop among our people. Interesting to note, though, while the United States was talking all this stuff about communism, that we started to do some, you know, analysis. And in the Congressional Record of 1969, it is pointed out that since the formation of this country in 1789, from the formation of the country, but from 1789, the United States had intervened into the affairs of countries all over the world, particularly countries of color, 133 times before 1917. Meaning that before there was the formation of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the United States had found 133 reasons to fight and to go into other people's land, to take their resources, to dominate them before there was a question of communism. So therefore, the whole communism idea was nothing but a ruse that was used by the United States to try to put people into the war of machinery to extend the interest. We know that that had been established a long time ago, you know, even in the wars in Central America, where it was discovered that the people, that the intervention into Central and South America was based on trying to extend the profit range of the U.S. multinational corporations. So therefore, we found that the idea of trying to become part and parcel of the U.S. war machine did not have a benefit for the people who were being conscripted, who were being drafted, who were being asked to volunteer, but was only benefited the monopoly capitalists to control this country. We could go back, Carl pointed out the early use of soldiers of color, and we will romanticize and part of it become inculcated with the ideas of U.S. Legacy and tradition and romanticization of their whole history from Crispus Attucks in the Revolutionary War onto the Buffalo Soldiers. And many people never looked at the impact. They would rather look at the black people participating in the Buffalo Soldiers against the indigenous population rather than black people who participate with the Seminoles trying to resist the conquest of the Europeans in this country. So that kind of awareness is growing now. And as a result of that, it's very doubtful that black people would want to become part and parcel of the U.S. war machinery. However, due to the economic situation, we find that in a time of economic crisis when there is cutbacks in the social programs, including education, that many people view the U.S. military as an institution of higher learning of the last resort. But in a time of job crisis where there's no jobs, no employment, many people look at the U.S. military as the employer of last resort. As a result of that, during these last couple decade in the post-Vietnam era, and particularly after black people got victimized in the Vietnam War, many people did become volunteers, or to the point where they did become part of the reserves, and many people did join the military in the volunteer army. As a result of that, the threat that Samori pointed out in his opening statement, that the disproportionate number of black people in the service today is something that we become very, very concerned with. There's already an acknowledgement by a secret Pentagon paper that in the first 20 days of the war in the Gulf, 30,000 GIs will die. They have already acknowledged that, and just Jack Anson the other day just released these figures, and they were already planning that this many people are going to die. They say that Saddam Hussein has already said he doubts the United States could take 10,000 deaths, the kind of deaths that they took in the Iraqi war. But the point is that this government was so sinister that to send people out to protect oil profits, so that the oil patch of Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas could make the profits, that Bush now in his home state of Texas, which was now becoming almost dried up, and where the oil profits were so low, are now laughing and happy that this war has raised the price of oil. The idea that April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador, told Saddam Hussein that you need to raise the price of oil, and that was due to the fact that it was true that the Kuwaitis had ripped off the oil from the Rumala oil fields, which belonged rightfully to Iraq, that they had a claim, and the United States was not interested in any intra-Arab dispute, that if the Iraqis decided to move in their own way against to resolve that contradiction, they would not deal with it. But it is now in the best interest of Bush and the Western allies who armed Saddam Hussein, who looked askance when the poison gas was used against the Kurds, against the Iranians, who now try to make him into some kind of a Hitler because that's a flash word in the U.S. Mindset. So for these reasons that we feel that the resistance to the war is not only is something that is just an academic argument, it's not rhetoric, it is something that is mandatory if we're going to actually preserve our own people, because the working people here are the ones that are going to have to fight that war to preserve the wealth of the rich. And anytime you have a situation like that, it is not one that's going to benefit the whole country. only benefit a few people who are going to not just make profit off the oil of the Middle East, but the blood of the people of the United States. Thank you very much.